Thank you, Monica, for getting the recording going. Once again, good morning, all. We will begin with about 20 minutes of meditation and then some Dharma reflections. So it's still chilly on the northern coast of California. Well, we're not really northern, actually, but north central anyway. I am well, bundled up here. Let's begin. Sorry. Just establishing posture, this key starting point of meditation that the Buddha says to go to the forest or the root of a tree or an empty hut, and placing the body erect, establishing mindfulness. Mindful, we breathe in. Ever mindful, we breathe out. Just this simple starting instruction can really be enough, actually, just to set the body erect. And establish mindfulness. Even when we do this, when we come into stillness, closing our eyes or just lowering the gaze, right away we're confronted with ourselves or what we experience as ourselves, sensations in the body. Feelings, streams of thought, and so this simple instruction to ever mindful breathe in, ever mindful breathing out becomes our refuge. It can feel, especially at the beginning of a sitting, almost as if we're trying to hold back the river, hold back the tide. If there's a lot going on for us internally, can be challenging to stay with the breath for any sustained period. And that's really part of the practice, is accepting the challenge of returning over and over. returning to the breath without adding some conflict or struggle. And so we try to bring a quality of kindness or gentleness to that effort. Those energies that pull us away, when we tune into the feeling of those energies, we are touching into dukkha, the craving, underlying craving that gets a grip on us. It can be easier just to surrender to the craving. So in ordinary life, we just keep moving, keep busy, filling the mind, keep the body active. But when we sit down to meditate, we at least temporarily give up that movement and accept the waves of energy that come over us, that break over us. And we continue to breathe, ever mindful. Breathe in, ever mindful. Breathe out. And somehow through that persistence, eventually something shifts. There's no timeline for that shift. We get no guarantees. But we discover that invariably at some point, that shift towards calm, towards spaciousness, finally starts to take hold. And in the meantime, before that happens, we are carried by faith, by our trust in the practice itself, by our trust in the power of mindfulness. Okay. One moment. I am going to see if I can grab a book off my shelf. Be right back. Nope, couldn't find it. Anne asked me to speak about spiritual urgency, not emergency, actually, but spiritual emergencies. Spiritual emergency is completely different. I'm sorry, just getting distracted here for a moment. The book I was looking for, I can't remember the title of it. That's why I wanted to find it, just to see the title. It's by Tan Jeff, Tanisaro Bhikkhu, who is known as Tan Jeff. Anyway, the term that came up was, I'm going to put it in the chat, Samvega. And I encountered it in this book probably 15 years ago. And I'd never really heard the term. I don't think I had heard the term. But the way Tan Jeff described it and defined it, it sounded really kind of familiar and a really useful idea. And I don't know even the technical Pali translation, because I've very much kind of taken the germ of the idea that I got from him and run with that kind of this idea of sort of feeling that our life and that it's the ordinary way that life is offered to us as this place where you can, you know, I'm thinking of Bob Dylan, you know, 20 years of schooling and they put you on the day shift, kind of, you know, this, just the cycle of, you know, 2.5 kids and, you know, save up for retirement and then have a heart attack after they give you a watch. Just sort of like, what's the point of it all? And of course it resonates with addicts, with people in recovery, because, you know, we were in a much worse version of that, that kind of empty, pointless life, going nowhere. Something that, as I was thinking about this while we were, I was supposed to be meditating, it reminded me, there's a story in Bhikkhu Bodhi's book, The Great Disciples of the Buddha. It's actually, he edited that. It was actually put together by some other people earlier, but he finished it up. Anyway, there's a story about two of the Buddha's senior disciples when they were children or teenagers, Sariputta and maybe Mahamoggallana, but I know it's Sariputta and one of the others, but they were, you know, and when you read these stories, they're really fun if you're interested in just sort of some of the mythology and people who around the Buddha, that because the in these stories they're always like reincarnated in like they always like know the Buddha, and they always are like, you know, they're married to each other, or their brother and sister, or their, you know, friends, whatever, or one of them is the king and the other one is their counselor and the other one is the queen and the other. So in any case, earlier, this is during their lifetime of when they were students, you know, disciples of the Buddha. And as teenagers, they, in their hometown, the circus comes to town. And they're really excited, and they go, and the first day, it's like really magical, and all the dancing, and the, you know, I don't know what they did in, you know, 500 BC Indian circuses, but we can imagine lots of, you know, flame jugglers and knife swirlers. In any case, they love it, right? So they come back the next day. They're like, yeah, it's good. Yeah. And by the third day, they're like, ugh, this just isn't doing it for me anymore. This is, and they both have this kind of insight that, like, this is kind of like the way life is. Like, it looks really great at first, but then it's like kind of wears off. Like, there must be something more, right? And so they make a vow. They're going to, each of them is going to try to find a master to be their teacher so that they can find some meaning in life, something more meaningful than the circus, you know. And so eventually, they have Brahmin backgrounds, so they're very upper class, but they leave their families, and both of them go out searching. They become samanaras, you know, and one of them does, you know, encounter the Buddha or hear about the Buddha, and so he finds the other, and they do become eventually followers of the Buddha. But it's very much that's Samvega, and that they encountered after the third time of seeing the circus, and I think it is something that teenagers often have, and there's this kind of the wisdom of the teenager, you know, maybe that should be a book, right? Because a lot of the bad things that come out that teenagers do come out of their samvega, right? You know, taking drugs or dropping out of school or joining a rock and roll band. Okay, I'm just talking about my own life, but you know, running away and you know, there's this kind of like, what is this it? You know, is this all there is? You know, I often think of it, you know, one of my sort of models for how addiction starts is that as children, if we are raised in a somewhat functional situation, I know this doesn't apply to everybody's childhood, but in a sort of typical American childhood, it's like the world is kind of magic, right? And the stories that are read to you are like magical stories and princes and princesses and unicorns and you know, and it's about play and you know, and then you have to go to school and all that stuff, but then you get out, you know, and so there's always this sense that really the world is magic, right? And then we become teenagers and it starts to become clear, like, well, no, it's not really, like playing in the sandbox doesn't really do it for me anymore. But where's my magic? And then we discovered drugs and alcohol and maybe other things. And it's like, oh, replacements for childhood magic. You know? And so I'll go with this. This is good. And then, of course, it doesn't go well if we have addictive tendencies. That search for magic leads us into dark places. So, I mean, which is one of the reasons why I talk about recovery as a return to innocence, like going back to some, you know, I don't know, purity, innocence of childhood, or maybe it isn't even a childhood that we actually had, you know, but trying to find that and realizing that actually within life, there is this joy, there is this inherent joy to be found in existence. And it's, but it does require this letting go of craving, but letting go of looking beyond, you know, the ordinary in a way. You know, my friend Bill Alexander wrote a book about recovery and Buddhism called, that was retitled Ordinary Recovery, you know, and I had a friend, an early teacher back in LA, who called his Dharma Center Ordinary Dharma. And that's a very Zen idea, right? Like just finding the beauty in raking the leaves and finding the joy in you know, a simple meal. So let me get back to this idea of spiritual urgency. One of the traditional teachings says that once someone attains the first of the four stages of enlightenment, that one's sense of urgency about attaining full enlightenment increases. Now, which is really interesting to me because, you know, this is the first stage is called stream entry, Sotapanna. And you know, I always think, oh man, if you just get to stream entry, like that would be so great. You could like kind of kick back now. All right, good. I've got my first stage. I'm pretty set, you know, because there's some other stuff that goes along with that. You know? But no, apparently that increases people's urgency. And I think that's, you know, many of us encounter that in our Dharma practice. Do we encounter it in our recovery? Maybe if you've relapsed, you get even more urgency when you get sober again. But certainly, you know, for myself, when I started to practice, you know, I kind of put my toes in, and then I did get really excited about meditation and retreats and Dharma practice. So that's one thing which I think is kind of curious and interesting, just like sort of an example. But I think coming back, I think that what Anne was asking about, and you can correct me, Anne, if you want, was kind of losing the urgency or how to sustain it long term. It seemed like that was what you were referring to. And I think that is ultimately the big question is, I don't know if it's the big question, but it's certainly an important question. Because the sense of magic in practice, or the sense of something really deep and rich happening, isn't something that tends to be sustained. And of course, you know, everything is impermanent. So, you know, we go through periods of excitement, or you go on a retreat and you're like really engaged in your practice. And then 6 months later, you're like, oh, do I have to meditate right now? Like, what's the point? You know, am I getting anything out of this? And this is where, internally, we really have to look at our commitment and maybe arouse our own samvega, remind ourselves what's important. But this is where certainly the parallels with recovery are really clear, that there are certainly times when people, you know, I mean, this is when we're really in risk of relapse, is when it seems like nothing's really happening in our recovery. And maybe there are crises in our lives. We're just kind of plodding along. And it seems pointless. You know, I can really only talk about my own experience with that, which is that, you know, in terms of recovery, for me, the firewall is step one. It's that no matter what's going on, if I think my version of step one, which is that shit doesn't work anymore, there is nothing left there. There is nothing to go back to. That's not going to fix anything. It will never, ever work again. That's step one for me. And so that no matter what other stuff is going on that seems unsatisfactory or difficult or painful, that's never a solution. So I guess my application of that, my Dharma practice on a very basic and daily level is there's nothing that's going to be made better today if I don't meditate. No. There isn't something I'm going to do that's going to be a better use of my time. You know, no matter how boring and tedious and spaced out my meditation seems to be, if I don't do it, whatever I do with that time isn't going to be better. It might be more distracting, and it might be less difficult, and it might seem more pleasant, but it's not going to be of more benefit. And it's really not going to make me feel better in any kind of long-term way, or even probably in a short-term way. So what I think is one of the things that I recommend to people when they're questioning whether they're getting anything out of their practice is to notice how they feel at the end of the meditation period. Don't think about how you felt the first 10 minutes or first 20 minutes or for however long your sit is. Notice how you feel when it ends. Because at that moment, it's pretty rare when I don't feel better than I felt when I started sitting. It probably happens occasionally that my meditation is so agitated because I get caught in some resentment or some fear here that I can't seem to break out of. But that's so rare that most of the time, if I'm just spacing out and I'm just kind of like, you know, I just don't feel really any inspiration, when I ring the bell or when the bell rings, there's a nice feeling. There's a sense of relief. And that's what I really need to tune into if I want to, you know, because what we're talking about here in a sense is just how do I keep myself going? What sustains me? And So one of the things we can say sustains us is the deep knowing that this works. So that knowing, you know, comes into the body. It comes, it's like in the neural pathways, the faith neural pathways, you know, the belief neural pathways, that like, if I think of meditation, I think, oh, that's going to be good. and there's just no doubt, right? The confidence in that process. And do you want to say anything more on this?
Yeah, thank you. I, you know, I've heard you talk about the magic of childhood before. Yeah. And today I was just thinking about how, I mean, I went right from childhood to drinking. I mean, I didn't literally, like, my transition point was drinking. And I always thought it was, at least I always focused on, you know, well, my older sister introduced me to it. It felt excellent. It was like the thing.
Yeah.
It took away all the pain from being at home, whatever, being in this body, being an anxious person, whatever. But this idea of, it just really, I felt it today where you said the magic just, because my childhood felt really great. I mean, I lived in a place where we played all the time. Yeah. Everything was magic outside.
Yeah.
I was this like child of nature. Everything was just, and then we moved to the East Coast and that's when all. but yeah, I mean, I really see that yearning to keep that spark going, you know, and I found it in, you know, alcohol and other drugs, but mostly alcohol. So yeah, as I was meditating, I was thinking, yeah, what does sustain me? And I thought, well, you know, I think that's partly why the Buddha taught the five recollections, right? To practice this, to know that this is what's going to happen.
You know? Right.
And then I just went into like, well, the four great efforts, you know, too, and how much joy I find in practicing the Brahma Viharas, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And that is sort of the, along with mindfulness practice in daily life, that's where, those are the things that sustain me. That gives me energy, that gives me confidence, that gives me, you know, the momentum to keep practicing and keep studying more deeply. Maybe this is coming up because, you know, I went on the retreat a month ago and it's, you know, it's still with me very much, very much the practices and stuff. But at the same time, there's this like, okay, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, I want for some of the folks who aren't as steeped in the lists to review some of the things you brought up.
Uh-huh.
The five daily recollections or contemplations are a good one, because you're exactly right. That's clearly what the Buddha was, the reason he was teaching that was to encourage people to sustain their engagement. So the recollections are, the first four are about impermanence, that we're of the nature to age, to sicken, and to die, and that everything that we're attached to is going to change. And you know, it's interesting. I mean, you know, the Buddha, as we know, doesn't always offer the most like, yay, kind of teachings where you get really excited. But he's saying like, you know, your life is short and you really need to practice. And then the fifth recollection is about karma. I'm born of my karma, heir to my karma, related to my karma, the owner of my karma. And whatever I do and whatever I think, say, or do, that's what I'm going to inherit. So, you know, urgency and careful, being careful, kind of suggested here. Something else came to mind, but the four great efforts are the effort to avoid the unarisen negative states, to abandon arisen negative states. I'm saying negative states is a very general term, so we can maybe could be put better, but unwholesome states, I think, is the term. Cultivate unarisen wholesome states and sustain or maintain arisen wholesome states. So it's about letting go and avoiding and letting go of the unhelpful things and then trying to cultivate more helpful things. And then the Brahmaviharas are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Another thing that comes to mind when we talk about this topic is just ritualizing your practice. Rather than thinking, oh, what am I going to get out of my meditation today? Comparing mind, like it was better yesterday, or it's, kind of measuring am I improving, any of that. It's really just what we do. It's just what we do. The Korean Zen master Sun Sanim, I heard him one time say, every day we wash our bodies, but where do we clean our minds? And it's like, oh yeah, I take a shower and I meditate. Take a shower for my body, I meditate for my mind. But to ritualize, because the five daily contemplations are something that I recite every day in my practice. And I know a lot of people use loving kindness or compassion practice as a part of their daily practice. And people in the recovery world, there's prayers that people do. And so ritualizing daily practice is a good way to just be like, this is what I do. And obviously, the limits of ritual are that they become rote and we stop. It's hard to always stay connected with them. But for me, the primary ritual is coming down into this office here where I am. I sit over there in the corner. And the primary ritual is coming down here and sitting down in the chair, and staying there. And the other parts of the ritual are just, little things that I tag on. But the main thing is that I come down and I sit in the chair. And, that does a lot of the work. I see Larry, I think, maybe spotted the book that I was mentioning. The Mind Like Fire Unbound. I think that is it. I'm trying to see your chat in there again, Larry. Where is it?
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah, The Mind Like Fire Unbound. I think that is the book title. How did you happen to...
Well, I just Googled the right words, I guess.
Okay, and that showed up, yeah.
Yeah,
and I mean, it's worth reading because, you'll get something completely different from what he says and from what I say. Yeah. So, for what it's worth. But thank you. Sure. That's helpful. And then, Monica put in some other links there. I guess it's an article in Tricycle and Samvega. So easy to confuse peace and boredom. I think that's a really great point. And especially for people who are used to stimulation or intoxication, it's like serenity. Who wants that? And the Buddha says that. I mean, this is a simplification, but the idea is peace is the highest happiness. You know, nirvana is very peaceful. It's like a fire gone out. I think we do have to, Larry, maybe put that in the regular to everyone, or maybe I can find it again. Because I know you sent it directly to me.
I just did.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's sure. Great. For others who are looking for that. Peace and boredom, you know. I've heard it, Stan, or what's his name, the founder of Gestalt Therapy, Fritz Perls, having said something like, boredom is the lack of attention, which I think is really interesting, right? It's like, oh, if you're bored, it's because you're not really paying attention, that there, meaning that there's always something interesting in the world, in your life, in your perception, internally or externally, maybe both. So I think that's a helpful just reflection to kind of like ask ourselves.
That Fritz Perls thought boredom is lack of attention. And then I just thought of Mary Oliver. Attention is the beginning of devotion.
Mm-hmm. Wow, very nice.
Yeah.
Anyone else have anything they want to chime in with this morning? Oh, Steve, hi.
Wow. This conversation this morning really triggered something in me that I don't think I ever, in all the years of living and dealing with recovery and all of the stuff I've been through, when you started talking about how we transition from childhood to being a teenager, that period of time,
yeah,
I really remember how traumatized I was because I didn't want to grow up. Mm. I never wanted. I had the big sandbox on the farm and all my trucks and cars, and I played by myself, and I was always alone. My brothers were out running. And now it just triggered this incredible memory of how I ended up getting into the food early on as a child.
Mm.
And that I never really thought about that. This is the first time I think in my life that maybe that's what really triggered my food addiction.
Yeah.
I just was terrified to grow. I didn't want to grow up. It took me a long time to move out of that phase of my life. So yeah. Thank you for that. That's amazing. Amazing that came to me like that.
Mm.
Anyway.
Very interesting.
Pretty powerful stuff.
What is that song from some play? You know, I won't grow up. I don't want to grow up.
I don't want to grow up.
I don't know what that.
Did not want to grow up.
I know.
People made fun of me because I was playing with my trucks and cars. What are you doing? You're supposed to be out doing because I want to stay playing with my trucks and cars. You know, I just want to stay a boy.
that's Peter Pan, huh, Cheryl? Okay, thank you.
can I just share something?
Sure, sure, Larry. Go ahead.
It's near the end of the hour. Just following up on some of the. The chat, I love that Mary Oliver quote, and it reminds me of another one, which kind of brings us back full circle, that she says, what will I do with this one precious wildlife, something like that. And it kind of brings it back to play, and it comes from the inside. So I love the idea of attention.
Yeah.
And going inside can bring us back to that play that we did feel in childhood.
Mm, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. It's interesting that, you know, that I was teaching a day long on the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing this weekend. And, you know, you get through the first steps of mindful breathing, just aware of the breath, aware of the body, calming the body. And the next thing that's meant to happen is awareness of of a pleasant feeling, of a rapturous feeling. And, you know, many of the teachers that I'm sort of reading and quoting about this sutta kind of point to this idea that once the mind settles and the body gets calm, that some pleasant feelings come up. And we don't really talk about that much in the mindfulness meditation world, because it's like, oh, well, don't get attached or don't start striving for pleasant feelings. But the Buddha is really pointing to this. And he's, I think he wants us to enjoy our meditation. It's, he's not trying to make us suffer, you know, but a lot of times we can, that's kind of how we interpret it. Oh, it's so hard to meditate. And so one of the suggestions, and you have to be careful with this, but one of the suggestions is that once you do settle in, to actually look for a pleasant feeling and then just like focus on that for a while. And again, it's, there's a obviously a risk in that. If we jump to that, like try, where's my pleasant feeling and I need to get it going, and you know, but if we take the time to settle, then to spend a little time with the pleasant feeling, it's kind of like, yeah, looking for the pleasant or the beautiful in our world. And again, I'm very skeptical of the sort of what I call, you know, the what's called toxic positivity of like, I'm just going to only see what's good and I'm only, and don't say anything negative. And that's sort of, I consider nonsense, but it's also, there's a skillful way in which we can engage mindfully and lovingly and compassionately to the present moment to bring out the underlying peaceful and joyful elements. Again, just, you know, every time I say that, I'm like, yeah, but I don't want to, you know, go grasping, but you get that. So just to share that a little bit. I think we've used up our morning time. I appreciate, thank you, Anne, for the prompt. And Vicky, are we meeting right now? Okay. So everyone else, thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
All thank right. you.
Wonderful.
Thanks,
talk.
Anne.
Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin.
So, see some of you this afternoon. And otherwise, Friday night, I shall be here. Yes, this is not Spirit Rock Night Week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Monica, you'll end the recording.
Just a minute. Just a minute.